So there's one employee at the Internet Archive who I always appreciate speaking with. I'd rather not give his name, but all of our conversations involve something interesting happening in the true "may you live in interesting times" curse. It's always something's gone wrong, we're hearing from an unusual party, everything needs your attention because we're in an emergency situation. So when he reached out recently, I knew it was going to be a good one. In this particular case, it was a trouble ticket that had been opened because a letter had come in, and it was thought wise to let me know the contents of the letter. I'm going to read off the letter right now. Famous people with hardly any name sometimes have accidents all the time, walking down large stairs or slowly walking across a street, because most people are on their phones in New York all the time. So, smack, a big arse truck slams into them hard, man. I think he will get the picture. Keep in mind, I will be in my home when the news hits New York about his death in the future. Just watch and see, man. Naturally, my colleague was extremely worried for me and felt really badly about passing along this message, and I had to explain to him that, for many people, death threats represent a traumatic experience. But for me, they're a Tuesday. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Daniel Boyd, Eric Vitello, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. It stands to reason that if you open up low-consequence lines of communication, cases where people can send messages without feedback as to who they are, or getting in trouble if they send something untoward, that people will send something untoward. You might get 100 messages of accolade and love, but you might get a few that are anything but. What I think people who don't work on those front lines understand is that that number, that percentage of untoward, threatening, and difficult to parse messages is much higher than they might think. It is not hard in the modern era to be able to open up a keyboard anywhere, send a message of any stripe, and get it into the desk, into the mind of whoever you're aiming for. When people communicate with you and they're coherent and have something to say to you that you need to respond to, and you respond to them, your mind moves on. You don't even notice how many you've done. If you're lucky enough to be in the center of a lot of communications, you're going to find yourself communicating with hundreds or thousands of people in a month, and then it just kind of slips away. But when somebody uses those ways and means of reaching you to send threats, insults, and anger, perhaps the memory of them lingers a little longer. You tend to remember when somebody claims that you're going to die, and especially when they indicate they're probably going to have a hand in it. For people who track this sort of thing, you know that the main reason I had an issue with Wikipedia back in 2004 was that the entry, for me, had my real full last name, something I generally don't use. And I was pretty unhappy about that at the time. I did not like the idea of this nascent website giving away ways to find me, giving people one more easy step to tracking me down. Naturally, the Wikipedia editors, who insisted on keeping my real name up there, did so, claiming that as the final arbiter of truth and knowledge, Wikipedia needed to give this information away. In the ensuing couple of years, I got that changed. Wikipedia is, in the modern era, much more receptive to treating living people with a level of respect and knowledge for their conditions that just didn't exist in 2004. But the reason I was so insistent on not having my real name there was because of the death threats. I received one of my first death threats back when I was running a BBS at the age of 16, and this was a memorable one. Not only did the person indicate my impending doom, they were able to describe which window was my bedroom at my house. In other words, the threat was beyond credible. It had moved into imminent. How I processed that at the time, I don't even remember. I do know I didn't want to bother my father, because my thinking was, if it happened, it happened. Nothing we were going to do, nothing we were going to provide any sort of police, especially when the threat had come through a bulletin board, was going to do anything. I was going to brave whatever came next on my own. Like a lot of these threats, nothing really came of it. Nobody showed up in my front door, nobody left anything for me, nobody called my other numbers, and I certainly wasn't accosted at school or in any of my mall trips. While the fact that they knew so many details about my house and my living habits indicated that the person knew me, probably went to my high school, that's about all I know. Relationships in high school seem very complicated at the time, and looking back, I understand why I was both happy to be in a high school that was better than where I had been, but also willing to take this sort of abuse, because I figured, at the time, it was just the price of running a bulletin board system. There you were, giving away your phone number to the world, letting people use your computer, and not having, really, any way of stopping anybody from calling and saying anything they wanted. When I tell people that story, there's a natural urge to move into a sort of combination forensics and revenge approach, wanting to determine exactly who it was and exact some sort of punishment from them. I think that's a natural response. You think of something being an injustice, it's portrayed to you as such, and then you move in and you think that you have the tools, especially with age and decades, to find out who it was. That's baked into how we are. But that wasn't the only time this happened. Running my mud in my 20s, a variety of people would come in and send death threats and promises of violence. And to various degrees, I would ignore it, act on it, or track the person down, and more likely, his parents, and set things on a better path. Each exciting turn I took, from running a mud to working on a website like textfiles.com, to the documentary work, to being involved in hacker conferences, and now the Internet Archive, means that information about me is out there, and that aforementioned ratio of people who just want to communicate with you and people who can cause you ill in a very, very small amount of energy expended will just keep happening. There's an incredible amount of opportunity when you allow yourself to become known by others. You can start conversations what feels like halfway through. People come to me, they know what I'm here for, they know what I'm about, what I've said, and I can get right to business. That's very, very exciting. People will come to me with a box of materials, we won't be having a discussion about why those materials are important, and they walk away with me smiling and telling them they've done a very good job. I get those all the time. But having that connection, that openness to being reached, means that anybody can use those lines when they feel like it. There have definitely been cases in my Internet Archive era that there are people with telephones and, as far as I can tell, very little else, living off assistance and using this phone as a way of yelling at the world, yelling at a rapidly shifting set of targets, people who they perceive have wronged them or which may give them a leg up to some sort of better life or better success, and becoming more and more aggressive in what they're doing. There have been people who I've tracked down who have sent death threats who are living in homeless shelters, moving from different public spaces, and who have an extremely cheap cell phone that they can use the Wi-Fi for and send endless, angry messages at a world that they feel has done them very, very wrong. Among them being the Internet Archive and myself, because here's the perception of a world of information, good and bad, being provided, and an implication that we want to hear from everybody about what's contained in the 60 million items in the stacks. Sometimes the letters are shockingly coherent, and other times they're a jumble, a word soup of ideas, while culminating in some sort of threat. Some are reported to authorities, others, it's understood. This is the price of the internet. Probably the weirdest and worst death threats we tend to get are people who comment on VHS tape digitizations, uploads of television shows, cartoons, commercials, basically video from the 1980s and 1990s. People will put up varieties of shows and pieces of shows with the original commercials in them, and folks will, quote, review them, unquote, by demanding other very specific shows, demanding that we have the November 15th, 1988 edition of this news program, moving progressively from other things uploaded, not just television shows, but anything that person has uploaded, repeating what they're doing over and over. And it's kind of let go, removed for irrelevancy, until they eventually say those magic words, threatening violence. Now, wait a minute, you're saying. What exactly are they threatening violence over? Did I hear that right? Do I have to rewind? Are they saying that they're going to attempt to murder someone because they failed to digitize a specific episode of a television show? And I say unto you, yes. Yes, that is the small pebble that seems to drive the avalanche of response from folks. And unfortunately, for them, they do get reported. Sometimes you can find them pretty easily because the kind of person who draws the conclusion that not having a certain videotape is a capital crime tends not to be very secure with their personal information or where they're executing their threats. With empathy, I understand that this is a chapter in a life where priorities have gotten out of whack. I look at some of the fights that I had online and what they were about in my 20s, and I completely understand where somebody could become so obsessed with a view of a holy grail of an item, any item, that it completely eclipses their priorities. But that's the moment where they collide with the reality. This, of course, is completely different from the person who targets an individual, who has chosen a name, either because of a perceived slight or imagining some sort of evil that doesn't exist, but which they see very clearly, and then acting on it by describing to the person some of what they could do, playing as best as they can to tiptoe around direct threats because internally, they know that there's something they have to be careful of specifically saying that a person will die if they have anything to do with it, but not really thinking it all the way through. I had a person who mailed me every day for 13 years because of a perceived slight inside of a very old text file that happened to have the same name as himself, which matched on search engines, but clearly wasn't him, had nothing to do with him. But his demands that I take it out of search engines became daily threats, a 13-year saga that ended quietly one day when his letters stopped coming, and the text file lives on. Fundamentally, I understand that there's going to be a price for communication, that when you give people tools to shout into the darkness, some people will shout very loudly and for a very, very long time. In my later years, I've tried to become more empathetic about what leads a person down this path, what short-changed feelings they have, what injustices they've endured. And sure, a good percentage of people who are doing this don't deserve any of that. Maybe when you're feeling the world isn't really going your way, that seeing this clear crime being committed gives you an incentive to rally behind me, to take on this perceived enemy who has sent me a threatening letter about a truck. But I'll just say, as the veteran of hundreds, maybe thousands, of various threats over the years, it's an extremely small price to pay for the types of connections, the types of people who have come forward to me, online and off, become a part of how I live, my knowledge, my feelings, and given me a gift of conversations and knowledge that, if I had assumed the worst, if I had turned away from what I did at the time and what I do now, would have made me truly, completely impoverished compared to the riches that I feel. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Bekoyanu, Mark Pilgrim, Peter Healy, Emilio Oliveira, Ernie Hershey, Michael Rubin, Matt Reynolds, Manxalot, Sean Kelly, John Sturm, and Anonymous, along with the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere, who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. I got a letter from the IRS, and I'd hoped that it was some sort of accolade or a refund, but it wasn't. It was a bill for $14,000, the kind of bill that could change your life instantly, and the Jason of 10 years ago would have been devastated to see this. He would have put it down on a kitchen counter and not looked at it for days, terrified about what was going on. But the Jason of now, me, read it over and realized very quickly what was going on. You see, when you use Patreon, you have to transfer the funds. You can either transfer them to a bank account directly or put them through a payment processor like Stripe or PayPal. And I had chosen PayPal because, at the time, that was really the only choice I had. And the IRS had gotten a report from Patreon of payments made out, as well as from PayPal. And apparently, they weren't able to figure out that PayPal contained everything Patreon did. Therefore, their algorithms had decided that I had not paid taxes on my Patreon. Therefore, I owed not just the money, but interest and fees. One phone call to my accountant settled all of this. With the same dismissive snicker that I made to my death threat, my accountant told me that a single letter to the IRS, signed from me, accompanied by an amended return to explain the situation, would take that $14,000 bill and make it zero. The difference in how my life is lived now, focusing my curiosity and attention into taking care of my finances as a result of this podcast, has been fundamentally incredible. A life-halting stress was turned into a laughable annoyance, thanks to the efforts of people who donate to this Patreon and to the people who have supported me over the years in many different ways to make it clear that I'm not alone, that problems are solvable, and that joy is just around the corner.